The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. And New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is New York State Assemblyman Danny O'Donnell, who represents the 69th District, which includes Manhattan Valley, Morningside Heights, and the Upper West Side. Assemblyman O'Donnell is the first openly gay man elected to the New York State Assembly. Born in Queens and raised with his four siblings in Commack, Long Island, O'Donnell put himself through college and law school, earning BA in public affairs from George Washington University and a law degree from CUNY Law School. After 7 years as a public defender at the Legal Aid Society, he opened his own public interest law firm on the Upper West Side. His community practice helped clients with tenant representation, as well as civil rights litigation, ranging from employee discrimination to First Amendment rights. Welcome back, Assemblyman Danny O'Donnell.
It is always a pleasure to be here.
Danny, since I have this very close relationship with your district, having been raised there on 96th Street between Columbus Avenue and Central Park, how are things over there?
Well, like everyone else, you know, we're living in this quasi-post-COVID times, and, you know, a lot of turnover in the retail structure and the restaurants are really hurting, but we're hoping that things will begin to get better. The retail issue had been existing for years. I'm putting a lot of pressure, for example, on Columbia University because, you know, they're an institution in the neighborhood and they should not have vacant storefronts. I have some bills to help that, but, you know, whether they will help or not, we shall see.
How do you do that? What would a bill say to fill a vacant storefront? You can't charge too much money, or what would you do?
Well, we have a bill passed a law that said you have to have notification on the outside of the building who to contact about the building, right? So that's all for the purposes of possibly renting it, but also for the purposes of safety and, you know, snow removal. We also last year passed a bill that is mirrored on a Texas law that creates a historic business registry. And if you've been in business at that location for more than 50 years, you're eligible to be on the registry. And if you're on the registry, you may be eligible for federal tax credits. So, you know, longstanding businesses, I've nominated one already, but I will continue to nominate them in my neighborhood.
For those of us who work in and around Albany, I live in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, it's always interesting to me that people who run restaurants, for example, they can charge just about maybe a little bit more, you know, where you are than in this area. But somehow they stay in business. I don't know how that happens. Can you explain it?
It's a very, very difficult business to make a living at. And I know some restaurant owners, and, you know, these are good restaurant owners, and they pay their staff and, you know, all those other things. And, you know, there are months they make no profit. They make no profit. So it's very, very difficult business to be in generally. Bars are much better because a bottle of vodka doesn't go bad, whereas a $30 piece of fish does. So, you know, it's a hard business to run, but people who have that in their blood and have that the skill set do it. And I'm thankful because I enjoy my nice restaurants.
Me too. You live up there or you work up there on the Upper West Side. Does that give you special prominence in the legislature? In other words, that really, New York is the capital of the world, maybe, and maybe your area in particular is the capital of New York. I've always thought so.
You always thought so because you came from there. Yes, well, the truth is the gravity, the balance of gravity has shifted from the Lower East Side to the Bronx. And so I'm midway between those two things. As you know, 96th Street was for many years the color line. And so those people who lived above 96th Street often got less services than those who lived south of 96th Street. And I, in my 20 years, have fought like a Dickens to fix that.
That's right. And I lived on the south side of 96th Street, and you're quite right. That's exactly what the demarcation was. But when Park West Village got there and all the other stuff, that all changed, right?
It began to change, but, you know, I've been here for 20 years, and when I arrived, the only Olmsted-designed park in the city of New York that wasn't a landmark was Morningside Park. Uh-huh. And why was that? Because it was north of 96th Street, and people of color lived around it. And so I can give you hundreds of those sort of examples. You look at the subways. So at 96th Street South, all the trains on the one line had been fixed. Not mine. 103, 110, and 116 were pristine in their what they looked like when it was originally built. And Columbia University wanted to fix up its station. They gave some money, which got the MTA to renovate all three of them. And that led, of course, me to fight to make sure they did it in a way that reflected the history. They're historically accurate. But in the end, yes, we need more resources, the schools, you know, all these things were better south of 96th Street. But I'm trying to bring those days to an end.
Interesting. So, Danny O'Donnell, tell me something. My mother basically conceived and had built, along with the Mitchell-Lama people, the Riverside Neighborhood Assembly House between Amsterdam and Columbus Avenue. And the idea was that you could come in, but when you left, you couldn't make money. But then there was a change in that. You could make money. You could sell it for what it was worth. And, you know, the political establishment sort of went along with that. Am I misinterpreting all of that?
No, you're not misinterpreting it. What has happened is that people who lived in those places that many people originally wouldn't want to live in, or neighborhoods they wouldn't want to live in, and like Morningside Gardens, people who invested their time and energy in it feel or felt that they should participate in the profit part. And so I generally oppose privatization, which didn't always make me popular with the people who lived there. But, you know, it was built for a purpose, and the purpose was to allow generations of people who are not rich to be able to participate fully in the fabric of New York City life. And so some have remained as they were, and some have gone to the for-profit model. And Morningside Gardens is certainly an example of that. I don't think I could afford a Morningside Gardens apartment these days.
Let me go to some of the issues that you're dealing with in the legislature, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on them. I'm sure everybody else would, too. No-knock warrants. You have legislation to reform and redistrict the use of no-knock raids, the policing tactic that resulted in the recent death of Amir Locke and Breonna Taylor in Louisville nearly 2 years ago. New York has a long history of botched no-knock raids. Can you tell us some more?
Yes. So the execution of a no-knock warrant is allowed in New York law, and the police officers go to a judge and say, I want one of these. And the reality in life is they don't even think about it. They're signed on them, often with under 3 minutes of scrutiny, and no real serious look at what the facts are. So, you know, when you now have body cam on police officers, which may I remind people, the police officers fought diligently to not have that, we now get to see what actually happens. And in the Minneapolis case, we watched, you know, the execution of somebody on TV. And that is very, very disturbing to me, right? And so we do have a system where citizens are allowed to be armed. In that particular case, that young man had a permit to have that gun with him. And if you were sound asleep at 5 o'clock in the morning and someone bangs on your door, you know, what are you going to think, right? So the bill would limit issuing no-knock warrants to instances where life, human life, is in immediate jeopardy. So active shooter cases, kidnappings, homicides, terrorism would allow them. But the Minnesota case is pretty egregious because not only were they not looking for him, they weren't looking for anybody. They were looking for evidence. And I just, for the life of me, can't understand why that could be so important, that eight people had to let themselves into an apartment at that time in the morning. So my bill would restrict the use of nighttime search warrants, that they must be done between 8 and 6 unless there's a clear rationale given at the time of the executing of the search warrant.
Well, I'm sure the police are delighted with your bill.
I'm trying my best, right? I mean, you know, what I've always said when I passed, when I repealed 50A, which was a police privacy act in New York, I would always say to them, you know, this only, you know, doesn't hurt the good ones. It just ensures that if there are bad ones, maybe we'll know about that. And, you know, that took 5 years to pass, partially because it was so vehemently opposed by the police unions. But then George Floyd happened, and all of America watched George Floyd get executed. And the next day, the family knew the exact disciplinary history of that officer because they didn't have 50A in Minnesota. And so you had people who never in New York got the kind of information about their son's death that the family of Mr. Floyd got in Minnesota. And it's my thing. Marriage took 5 years to pass. 50A took 5 years to repeal. I don't know. Hopefully it won't take 5 years with no knock warrants. But I'm trying to make that happen with a coalition, a national coalition, which is extraordinary. Senator Sanders carries the bill in the Senate. And also now Lieutenant Governor Benjamin was very, very helpful. Campaign Zero, which is a nationally recognized organization, and DeRay McKesson is in charge of that, has been very, very helpful. And, you know, it happened just the other day in Pensacola, Florida. They executed a no-knock warrant, and thankfully no one died. But there were injuries, including of a one-year-old kid. And there's just no reason for it. There's just no reason for them unless someone's life is in danger. And the other problem is how current is the information? So if you have stale information when you go get a warrant and then you don't execute it for a week, you're really running the probability that, in fact, the information is inaccurate.
Okay. Then let's go from no-knock warrants, Danny O'Donnell, to bail reform. This is one that got very tricky for a lot of politicians. Now, New York City Mayor Eric Adams disagrees with the Democrats in his own party over this issue, taking a harder line and calling for letting judges use their discretion in allowing bail, which the Republicans have grabbed as a major issue in attacking Democrats, which seems to have worked in the last election cycle for the Republicans. Your thoughts?
There's a lot of false information out there. And I can tell you that even before bail reform was passed, much less implemented, the misinformation began. Okay? So now, statistically, only 2% of the people who are released without bail commit another crime and get rearrested. Do you know how little 2% is? If I lost 2% of my body fat, you wouldn't even notice. Okay? It's a tiny, tiny amount. So in the end, that statistic is not helpful for the see it's broken argument. It's helpful for the see it's not broken is really what it should be used for. When it was passed, all these gloom and doom things were what they were saying. And the truth is that it wasn't gloom and doom. We had a system that used wealth to determine whether or not you were presumed innocent.
No question.
That's not right, right? That's wrong.
That's wrong.
And that's wrong. And as a person who spent 7 years as a public defender, I can assure you that the number of people who were held in on a $1,000 bail went to some families $1,000 as pocket change and to some families $1,000 as a month's rent.
Sure.
So in the end, that system has to be fixed, right? So we attempted to fix it. And then they said, you know, you didn't do it correctly. We went back and changed it. Could there be ways to modify it? Maybe. But part of the problem is how the law has always defined conduct. So they, in New York law, a crime is deemed to be violent or nonviolent, regardless of an own individual's culpability in being part of the violence. So, you know, an assault is an assault, but an assault when somebody dies is a murder, right? And in the end, is someone's conduct violent? And, you know, I think that we've lost track of that. We went around designating almost everything as a violent crime, even if no violence was perpetrated, even if no violence was part of what happened, or the worst case scenarios are the acting in concerts. Somebody throws a punch in a group of kids, and the other kids with them, him or her, they're punishable by the action of another, because the overall thing is deemed as a violent crime. So those are things that we never really look at as to how we define what things are. And yes, there are people who have used it to their own benefit and have misrepresented what the change was. Let me be very clear. New York state law never permitted dangerousness to be used as an indication of whether or not somebody should be held in jail. Because we know dangerousness is a subjective judgment. What makes someone dangerous to you or to me may be different than somebody else. And if you watch the press conferences, all you hear is, why can't we use dangerousness?
But they're effective.
Well,
but Danny,
we never did.
But Danny, the perception on the part of voters, at least in the last election, seems to be it's an effective argument that captures people who want to be safe votes.
That's true. And that makes an uphill argument at times. But the truth is that the increase in crime is across the country. And it didn't start here. And it didn't start with bail reform. They didn't change the bail laws in Chicago. And look at what's happening in Chicago. So in the end, what causes crime and what is feeding crime is not about whether or not somebody's held for preventative detention. You go back to the 80s, and I lived in New York City in the 80s. It was a very, very scary place at times. And most people think Rudolph Giuliani fixed that, but that's not true. It was David Dinkins who brought in William Blatton, and William Blatton then became the police chief, and then, you know, started with community policing. And that's what made it better. And in the end, we have to come up with new strategies. Often, certainly in that era, you could track crime levels based on the age of the populace. So more people between 16 and 24 are violent than people who are older than 24. There was a judge in Brooklyn who used to sentence anyone charged with a violent crime to stay in prison until they were 40, because he didn't believe anyone committed crimes after they were 40. Don't ask me. That's what he believed. In the end, there is some statistical justification that the population that is most likely to result in committing violent crimes is a particular population, and what percentage of that, of the adults, is that population?
Let me ask you this. I want to move on because we're sort of running out of time here, believe it or not. And I want to talk to you a little bit about redistricting. So are the Democrats hypocritical for drawing districts to improve their advantages like Republicans have done? After all, for years, the New York State Senate was constitutionally Republican because of the way the lines were drawn. Or as Senator Jean Harris and others have argued, did they reset the districts to reflect the true majority of the Democrats in the state?
Well, a federal court will be making that decision one of these days. What I'll say is we've lived this. I've been here for 20 years. And not in New York City, but in other places, the districts were ridiculous, particularly on Long Island, where they would take places where populations of Democrats, populations of people of color were, and divide them into a quarter. And each quarter went to a different district. So at no point could anyone from that Democratic poor part of Long Island rise up to have those jobs. That clearly was wrong. In this time, however, what we have is already drawn districts. You know, what my district is almost identical to my previous district, which was almost identical to the previous one before that. So if you are looking at a Senate map, you're going to look at the Senate map and try to keep what has been together together. And what's not been together, you try to make it fairer. Did they succeed? I have no idea. I really don't. And but I find it at the very little bit irony that the people who mastered the art of drawing people out of power are now upset that when it happens to them, they don't like it.
You couldn't be more righter about that. That is for sure. Okay, so the pandemic has put a spotlight on landlords and tenants. You've represented tenants over the years. What's the state of the tenant-landlord relationship in New York? Do people on either side understand their rights and responsibilities?
Well, it's a very difficult one, and I have represented tenants for free in housing court before I became elected. And, you know, it's somebody's home. And so we have to make sure that that stays in our mindset. This is their home. The financial fallout from COVID has hurt people a great deal. And we have to make sure that people are not losing their homes simply because during COVID their income was limited or cut off. We can't have that. We have also, I got a phone call yesterday from a constituent about their rent being doubled. And, you know, who could have double the rent?
Yeah, that's true. But with the pandemic here and landlords needing some representation too, and I know you have more tenants in your district than you do landlords, but my question to you is, do the landlords ever get taken into consideration about what their needs are too?
Yes, absolutely. And we made sure that in the financial package, that we have a way for them to be able to get the resources they need in order to survive, right? But in the end, not everybody in a building during COVID was out of money. So there are many people who continued, were able to, and continue to pay their rent. And so, but yes, we always take them into consideration. But I, as a person, view a renter as that's their home. I mean, I live in a building that's four apartments per floor. And when I moved in 1990, the other three were all tenants. And when I ran for office, they said, oh, yeah, the new kid on the fourth floor, because they had all been there from the 60s. So these are people's homes, and they've lived there for a long time, and it's their full intention to stay there for a long time. And if a crisis like COVID is interfering with that, then government has to step into the void.
Okay. Now, Danny O'Donnell, I only have 2 minutes to go, so I want to ask you very quickly. This is the usual how are they doing question. How's Speaker Hastie doing, and how is the governor, Kathy Hochul, doing?
Well, I am thrilled with the governor. We finally have a governor who's normal and who is willing to work cooperatively, which we haven't had in over a decade. So I think she's doing a wonderful job. I'm able to call her people and say, this is a problem or this is a solution. And I also call them and tell them, you know, this is could be a political problem. I'm not a political advisor, but I certainly acknowledge the view of politics. She's smart. She's hardworking. She's pleasant. And you have access to her. And she's not a, you know, screaming maniac. So all those things are an improvement. Now Carl is doing a very good job.
Speaker.
You know, we're, as Speaker, we have 107 members. And I can tell you, trying to keep 107 people happy is like herding cats, okay? It's not something that's easy to do. But he does his best, and he tries. And there are competing interests. And in the last election, we had a significant turnover in our body. And, you know, not all the time are you getting people who have an understanding of the way things work. You know, it doesn't work the way a civics class says it's going to work. But if you figure it out, you can figure out how to advance whatever interest you want. But that does not mean that anybody gets everything they want.
Is he better at it than Shelley Silver was?
That is a very subjective term. You know, Shelley was a lawyer and you know, had a brilliant mind of, you know, in a Talmudic way, always, you know, keeping things open. You know, Carl's a math genius, so he does the numbers at a level that is mind-boggling to me. So they have different strengths, and I let them have the strengths they have and try to work with whatever I need.
Well, we're out of time. It's unbelievable. That is something that happens when you're talking to Assemblyman Danny O'Donnell, a Democrat from Manhattan, where I grew up. Thank you very much, Danny. We so appreciate your being with us.
Anytime. Thank you very much.
The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Or visit us online anytime at WAMC.org, or you can even schedule a podcast. And join us again next week at this same time for another Political Conversation with Alan Chartok. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.